meeting here. So I'd like to welcome everybody to the fourth and final bail bond oversight meeting. First order of business, we have Kathy, we have a new member, Kurt Oda. He's our public member. Kathy will come swear him in and we're going down.
All right. So, raise your right hand. I, Curtis M. Oda.
I, Curtis M. Oda.
Having been appointed to the office of the bail bond surety oversight board member.
That's a long one.
Yes.
Having been appointed to the bail bonds.
The office of the bail.
The bail bond.
Close enough.
Oversight.
Yes. Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
Or affirm.
Or affirm.
That I will support.
That I will support.
Obey and defend the Constitution.
Obey and defend the Constitution.
Of the United States.
Of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Utah.
And the Constitution of the State of Utah.
And that I will discharge.
I will discharge.
The duties of my office.
The duties of my office.
With fidelity.
With fidelity.
All right. Congratulations. Do you have a few words on that?
Welcome aboard, Kurt.
Condolences to that.
Mr. Chair.
Sympathy.
If I may ask for personal privilege.
Certainly.
I'm sure Kurt Webb is not a new face or new name to many of you. I know Commissioner Kaiser regrets that he was not able to be here today to personally welcome Kurt. I know that you did have a lengthy conversation with Commissioner Kaiser. But if you don't know, Kurt has been a representative in the Utah House of Representatives for 16 years, 12 years, and is no stranger to the issues of bail, is no stranger to how the legislature works, and is an avid gun advocate and a great guy. And Commissioner Kaiser wanted me to specifically thank you for agreeing to serve, and especially with your background in legislative matters and bail industry, and thank you.
Next order of business, have y'all had an opportunity to review our minutes? Motion to adopt.
Motion to adopt.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
No need for an executive session. No need to recommend actions for the executive session. Kathy, do you have a licensing report to give us?
I do. We have the months of July, August, and September for the agents and the agencies. What I'd like to point out is there are a few months here where August specifically and September where there aren't any reinstated licenses, but there are quite a few lapsed licenses. And again, just reiterating that the agency itself does receive an email indicating that an agent for them has had a lapsed license. So again, just make sure that you are checking that your agents are licensed and that your agents are actually checking that too.
Have any audit updates?
Yes, of the nine that I did start, there are two that have been finished and completed. The others are in the pipe and they should be finished fairly soon.
Fairly soon.
Yes.
And then your intention is to start all over?
Yes.
Anew and
yes.
Re-round?
Yes. Those who have not been audited yet, yes, they will be the next on the list, or new agencies are actually on the list after approximately a year.
Okay.
Really quick, Kathy, mm-hmm. Do you notify the agency after you
finished and it's completed?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. What happens is if everything's in compliance, they get what is called an audit findings report, and it will list everything that I have actually gone through and checked. When the agency audit is requested, a list of items are requested, and then I in turn explain where that fit in the policy or the code, and where it was all in order or where there was a problem. So it is a detailed report that you do receive.
Great. Well, thank you, Kathy, for your continued efforts. So if we can move on to some new business, and I don't believe Stuart Adams is here quite yet, right?
No, he isn't, but would you like to talk at all about the quarterly report? And the,
oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I skipped over that. Please do.
Okay. Basically, if we go to the open investigations that were opened in the last 90 days, obviously there were designation issues that were open and resolved. There were a few failure to pay judgments, which obviously the courts are sending over, and usually those are taken care of really quickly. The minute I notify the agency, of course they've got 5 days, working days, before we begin any other type of action as far as the suspension. So those usually are resolved very quickly within that period of time. Sometimes you notice that there are a few more days on there. Sometimes that's a weekend, or there's some information that has to come from the court, or there's a negotiation period too, sometimes with the court. So that's why sometimes the days are a little different there. The open enforcement cases, we still have one that is still in process, well, two actually. Three of the other cases that were open, they were closed July the 5th, and those we had talked about in the prior meeting had been resolved, but we're just giving you the information there as the ones were closed.
Try new business.
All right.
We have a speaker here from Surety Insurer, Mr. Weber here, J.L. Weber.
Yep.
Do you mind introducing yourself to us a little bit and explaining a little bit what information you might have for us?
My name is J.L. Weber. I work for Vail USA. We used to be an underwriter for Seneca Insurance. Vail USA was bought by HCC Tokio Marine recently, so we're a new company, and a lot of the old companies. So my title is actually Vail Account Manager. There are several of us that work for the company throughout the United States. I happen to have all of the states in the Rocky Mountain region, plus a few like Louisiana, Missouri. So my job is to basically oversee all of the Vail agents that work for our company in those given states. And so that's a pretty wide purview of duties. We don't actually recruit new agents. It's enough of a job to manage the ones we have. A lot of people come to us and want appointments, so we deal with them rather than recruit. My job is, in the early stages of an agent applying with us, is to do some of the background investigation, some of the vetting of that agent, where they came from, where they work, what are the sureties they work for. We do financial statements from them, we do credit checks and all of that sort of thing. So once the agent is appointed with us, we try to walk them through the process of how our company does business, things that we expect from an agent, how we do business, all of that sort of thing. We kind of like to, Vail USA has always prided itself in having the best bail agents as far as doing business the way that they're supposed to do. And I have to tell you that of the hundreds of agents that I deal with, they're great people. They're great business people. They're great family folks. And as opposed to some of the misled public's view of what bail agents are and what they do, they're great business people. We are active in the battle across the United States of this bail reform, and I suspect that there might be some questions about that. I certainly have a lot of comment about it, and I try to stay in presentations neutrally, politically neutral, which is very hard for me to do. But it is a real battle against the industry of bail bonding. I think in New Jersey, I got a lot of bail bonds people's attention because the entire state of New Jersey went away as far as surety bail, which a lot of people in the industry thought that just couldn't really happen, could it? Although there's a couple states that don't do bail. But from a strong bail state, New Jersey, we had many, many, many agents who worked there. And as of January this year, commercial bail or surety bail was out. The interesting thing is now the state of New Jersey is lamenting at how expensive this is. Well, many of us in the business could have told them that, but nobody wanted to listen. So I do overseeing bail agents in my given region. We do audits periodically, or there are some states that require yearly audits of the bail agents and all of their subcontractors. Like Colorado does that. Colorado happens to be where my office is. And I guess that's why I got the Rocky Mountain region, because I'm centered in the middle of it. So we audit things very intricately. And actually, for instance, in Colorado, there are certain, some say that Colorado is one of the highly regulated states, and it is. And I was one in the beginning, 2012, all of the laws were changed, and it became very much more restrictive in Colorado. I was one that screamed and yelled that it was over-restricted, and the truth of the matter is now, and I probably wouldn't say this openly in a Colorado bail agents meeting, but it's really a good thing. It really is. My problems in Colorado, of every respect, have been reduced in the last several years, probably 80%. Because it's regulated, now that everybody knows how they have to do business, forms they have to use, processes they have, fiduciary accounts that they have. When I show up to do an audit, it's just more or less verifying that they're doing what they're doing, what they're supposed to do, and everybody's doing it. So as opposed to some other states that are very loosely regulated in the bail industry, I have unbelievable problems there with forfeiture levels, collateral returns, you name it. And one of the things that I asked Kathy a moment ago is, when, you know, and I try in all the states that I operate in to make contact, when I'm there, I'll go into the Division of Insurance and tell them who I am and what I do and who I work for, and ask them to please let me know if there's an issue with an agent. I was telling Kathy earlier that when I first started with Bail USA, I was immediately handed a couple of just gigantic problems in the Phoenix area. Bail agents that were writing bad bond, they just basically, their forfeitures were out of control, and they wound up going upside down. I had Connex boxes full of collateral I had no idea who it belonged to or what case it went with. So finally, after I cried and screamed and yelled to the company enough, we have, you know, and like I was telling Kathy, I can't imagine that this was going on without somebody at the home office seeing a little flag. that we have a problem. But they did, so now we do. And one of my jobs is to head off any of those issues whenever we see an issue before it becomes astronomical for the agent or for the jury, and consequently the state. So anyway, getting back to what I was saying, I try to make contact with the Division of Insurance in every state that I operate in so that they have a phone number to call if they discover that an agent happens to work for Bell USA and they have an issue. If they just let me know right out of the chute, we'll take care of it, because we don't want problems, and life is a lot easier without them. So we ask with licensing issues, forfeiture issues, collateral returns, anything. We will fix the problem, and if we don't know about it, we can't fix it. So, popular to common belief, some of these agents, if they're in trouble, they really don't want me to know it because they got enough problems without having a surety down their neck too. But the issue is, of course, the bottom line is, it's our neck that's eventually in jeopardy. So if we can head off problems, that's one of my biggest jobs. So, yes, ma'am?
What agencies are licensed under you here in the state of Utah?
We only have one.
Eight.
That's the only one in Utah. Mm-hmm. And I was here several months ago and appointed another agency and vetted them, and about a month later we fired them. This didn't work out. Yes, sir.
With your experience with Utah so far, would you consider that a tight ship or a loose operated ship as far as
you know? It's probably tight, but then I have such a small, I have one agency.
What's it? What? Yeah, he regulates the head of us. What do you mean?
You know, now,
we're regulated.
In a state where I have 70 to 100 agents in the state, I could go down the list because I have more of an experience there.
In reference to New Jersey, and I don't know how familiar you are with that, but you basically suggested that your agents all went out of business there, correct? So did they give up their licenses, or did they?
You know, I don't, since New Jersey is not, I'm not affiliated with New Jersey, I don't know those kind of details, but I know that Shirley Bale was.
Do you know what the government department they were licensed through in New Jersey?
I think the Division of Insurance there. And I tell you, New Jersey, I have no doubt but what it will come back. Because as we all know, it's too expensive to operate a bail business within the state, because we're all of a sudden, instead of having independent contractors working within an industry, the state now is regulating it, or local jurisdictions in some places, and it's too damn expensive. And I'll give an example. In Colorado, this pretrial release thing has been occurring more or less county by county, as opposed to like New Jersey, where there was actually a state law that was enacted that abolished bail there. So in Colorado, we have several counties who have in the past or who have recently gone to a bail reform, pretrial release type system. It's either regulated by the jail in that particular county, or in some counties they have an independent company that, by the way, charges the living dickens out of the county to administrate that for them. So in Mesa County, which is Grand Junction, Colorado, was one of the very first state counties in the state of Colorado to go to a pretrial release program, and it was almost exclusive pretrial release. And they got government grants to do that, to pay for it. Within the last year or two, a lot of those government grants ended. And so the county discovered that, damn, this is very expensive to operate. So the first indication to me, listening to the grapevine, is that they closed down their UPS unit, their useful public service unit, where they sentenced a lot of these people. And they shut it down. And I went, wow, that's weird. I wonder why that is. Well, obviously it's funny. And so the agents that work for our company in Mesa County, Colorado, that were able to weather the storm and were smart enough to interact with pretrial release people and stay in front of the courts and gain a positive reputation now are reaping the benefits, because in Mesa County, everything is going back to commercial surety bail release, simply because it's unaffordable.
Were there any bail bond companies in Colorado that were advocating for this to get rid of their competitors that you know of? I mean, of course, they wouldn't do it openly, but in hindsight,
not that I'm aware of.
Ever came out?
You know, and I think everybody is, in Colorado, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, they seem to be unable to formulate a very strong bail association. If you guys are in the bail business, know bail agents are very strong-willed and opinionated, and to get a bunch of them in one room and all agree on something is pretty hard. So they don't have a strong association in Colorado, but they do communicate a lot. And I think everybody fully understands that pretrial release, unfortunately, Denver County in the heart of the Front Range is pretty much pretrial release. And a lot of our agents in the Denver metro area are just folding up. It's really sad to see.
How long was pretrial running in that first county that you talked about?
I'm sorry?
How long ago did pretrial start in that first county?
Mesa County, it's probably been 6-7 years. That it lasted.
It's a long storm to weather.
Yeah, it is a long storm to weather. I mean, they would, you know, they will do things like they will release the party on a $10,000 bond, and they'll give a $2,000 portion of it to the bail agent. So that's when they don't appear, and the bail agent goes after them for his $2,000, and hopefully they get them recovered, because as many of you know, under the bail reform, pretrial release, nobody's chasing these people. So if you get the agent on the hook for a portion of it, he'll hunt the guy in the state or the county. Doesn't have to. Yes, sir.
Would you be able to address pre and post pretrial in Colorado number of licenses? Would you have any figure for that?
I'm going to say probably
80
agents licensed, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, agencies are 80. However many different businesses?
Yeah, there's probably, I would have to guess, I'm going to say no more than a couple hundred probably.
So that was pre-trial? And now it's down to 200 or which figure is it?
Yeah, it's down to 200.
It's down to 200, so it's far more than that at one time.
Oh, absolutely. Prior to 2011, 2012, there were probably another 100 at least. Unfortunately, I've lost half a dozen agents within the last year.
And we say agents.
Agents or agencies.
Agencies.
And mostly in the metro area, because it's all of the surrounding counties in the Denver metro area, including Denver proper, have gone to pretrial. And you just can't make a living. Yes, sir.
So immediately after the grant stopped, that's when the system failed and started to come.
Yeah, in Mesa County in particular, yes.
How long did it be when Mesa County started before Denver started?
It was always there in Denver County and Denver Metro proper. It was always there. I mean, it's not a thing that like happens overnight in some places. It slowly starts occurring in Denver, let's say, for example, will institute it. And I don't know how pretrial necessarily gains a foothold, if it's through judges' conferences, county commissioners' meetings and conferences. I don't DAs, I don't know, but I do know that the picture of pretrial, one of the selling points is that we can help empty your jail. And everywhere it's been instituted, that doesn't happen. Larimer County, up in northern Colorado where I live, was one of the first ones, right along with Mesa. And their jail population continues to increase. You know, that, it just doesn't work.
Were you able to identify increased cost to pretrial versus what under the belt?
I don't have any of those figures because they're not, they kind of keep them close to the vest. But I can tell you that a year ago, Pueblo County, which is Pueblo City, went to pretrial release. They had a private company called Armand's, Rocky Mountain Offenders Management, come in and administrate their program. And it was started in August of the year, I think it was 2015. And they needed $500,000 to administrate that program from August to the end of the year. And the sheriff of that county at one time is a good friend of mine, and so he has a PI business now. And I asked him if he would, just for fun, of course we had to pay him to do it, but if he would monitor defendants in the Pueblo felony court system who were released on pretrial and the recidivism rate or the revocation rate of those individuals. So we randomly selected 100 people from just having one of his people sit in the courtroom. 100 randomly selected people, and 48% of those people were remanded back into custody because of violations. So the, you know, one of my friends in New Orleans who fights this business vehemently calls this very easily accountable and unaccountable bail. Bail agents being the accountable bail, the unaccountable being this pretrial release. Because they get released on their promise to appear. If they fail to appear, nobody looks for them. Or if they cut their ankle bracelet off, whatever.
And that's why the jails are still full.
Sure. Are you able to share that information with us?
I think so. I think I sent a copy of that study to my office, but I'm sure, I think I kept a copy of it. Yeah, I can get it too.
Okay.
Absolutely.
If you don't mind getting that to Kathy, and she can submit it to the board.
You know, and I mean, the whole business is wrought with stories about supposedly under pretrial, minor offenders, nonviolent offenders, yada yada, are released on pretrial. But the stories are just all over the country of New Jersey. Right out of the box, and shortly after the first of the year, they released some kid who raped and killed some 12-year-old girl. You know, and stories like that are in my state of Colorado. They're all over the country. Anything, and I'm ex-law enforcement, so I can tell, and I work in the drug unit, so I can tell you that anything related to drugs is not nonviolent. It just isn't. Now, you can tag a dealer on the corner selling drugs. It's not hurting anybody except for the drugs. Well, that business is a violent business. It just is. So anybody selling drugs, to call them a nonviolent offender doesn't wash with me, just because I know better.
A lot of this is actually part of the nationwide effort, state by state, what's called a justice reinvestment program. Mm-hmm. As you said, a lot of that has to do with let's reduce the numbers in the jails and prisons. And so we're seeing some of that being implemented here. What have we got in outstanding warrants?
200,000.
200,000. That's more than double in the last
what, year and a half?
I'm not sure exactly about that, but I know it's up. It's ever increasing.
Say that again.
There's 200,000 active warrants existing in Utah as of about last year. We haven't got a new figure in a year. But
in the whole state?
Yeah, from BCI.
Okay. And it's going to climb.
Well, I could give you half a dozen bail agents in some states that have that all by themselves.
We're just getting started.
You know, a lot of the auspices that they sell the pretrial release programs on, and I need to be very careful here that I don't get to, on the face, like many programs, should poor people that can't afford to pay a bail agent languish in jail? Well, any rational person would say, of course not. But it's, I mean, that sounds like a great program. Let's do that, because that's a good thing to do. But when you look at the nuts and bolts of the actual operation of the pretrial assessment, and really the assessment tool is the biggest fallacy in the program. For instance, in New Orleans, where one of our agents has taken up the fight and paid for a lot of it himself, the pretrial release instrument, the evaluation instrument in New Orleans, and the company that was running it there was called Vera, I can't remember what it stands for, but was 24 questions. And if you answered correctly of these 24 questions, you would be eligible for pretrial release. So they released a gentleman, 19-year-old kid, out of jail after this assessment tool. And a number of weeks later, he was in the French Quarter and he shot up the place and shot like 25 people. So he was a previous felon. At the time that he was arrested, he was a known drug dealer. He was in possession of a firearm when he was arrested, and a couple other things. And out of a possible score of 1 to 25 on the pretrial assessment instrument, he scored a 4 out of 25. So just out of curiosity, we ran Ted Bundy through that same assessment tool. He was a 6. So the flawed assessment tool, coupled by the fact that one of my questions has always been, who's administering this assessment tool? Because you guys all know that when somebody calls you for a bond, if you've been in the business for any number of years at all, when you're sitting face to face with these people, you know if this is going to be a good bond or not. If you have, for instance, in Pueblo County, they hired college students on an internship basis to administer these tests. What does a college kid that isn't even graduated yet know about questioning a hardened criminal about anything? Especially if they've been through this before and want them to.
Are they doing that through the criminology classes?
Yeah, I think so.
Or sociology, which one?
You know, and they're cheap. So
here it's even worse, they're using a computer.
Yeah, the system here is non-interview. There's no interview involved at all.
Algorithm.
It's completely computer-based.
And you being former law enforcement, you know, as well as I do, that certain ways of profiling without actually profiling, in the legal sense, is a very useful tool.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, everybody profiles. I profile every one of you when I walked in here. Okay.
You know, there is such a thing, and bail agents have it. I see it all the time.
Yeah.
They have an educated, experience-based sixth sense.
Educated guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Under this PSA, it eliminates looking at race, gender, income, education, home address, drug use history, family status, marital status, national origin, employment, and religion.
Those are all overlooked?
Yes.
Completely.
So for one, you could hop off a bus and get arrested in Utah, and as long as you don't have a Utah criminal arrest record and you're off the bus, you're going to appear to be a first-timer, good to go.
Wow.
Well, and one of the problems we're having here, I feel, I mean, they are planning on implementing it statewide in November here. And I think it's just failed education. I don't think that people understand what's really going to happen and what the cost associated with it will be. Because we weren't involved in the process at all. We were just told, you know, this is what's going to happen. And we kind of did the same thing New Jersey did for a long time. There's no way. That can't happen here. Utah's so conservative. But another question I have, too.
Well, the problem with that is we're also very forgiving.
Well,
okay,
but,
that was the crossover.
But here's what's concerning to me. So now we have a pretrial system in Salt Lake already, and there are parameters. If it's domestic violence, if it's DUI, if it's anything aggravated, you know, they have to develop, because where's the liability? So pretrial releases somebody, they get out, and they shoot people up or, you know, hurt kids or whatever. Where is the liability laid? Because the state of Utah has signed a contract that essentially saves the software, and we're dealing with the Arnold Foundation. It's their software that we're dealing with, but they have no liability.
$500 worth.
Yeah, $500 worth. If I had $500 worth of liability, I'd bill every person. You know, I mean, $500 of liability, that's insane.
The state's also required to release 80% of the people they run through it on OR.
Because they're doing a Harvard study here. Because at this point, it's not.
With no conditions. OR
program.
With no conditions.
So we have some pretty big concerns here.
And justifiably so.
Are you, is Bell USA a member of American Bell Coalition?
Yes.
And you work with Jeff Clayton?
Yep. And I think he's been here, I think.
Yes, he has. You need to sit down and let him just bring you up to date on exactly what's going on.
I actually just saw him in Idaho last month. And they are having a big meeting, which I'm begging to go to. I just saw it the other day. And it's put on by him just to kind of upgrade everybody and update them on what's going on across the country. He is instrumental in combating this
absolute
problem. And he's, in case any of you don't know, he's the American Bell Coalition is funded by all of the sureties, for the most part, that are involved in the bail bond business. So, and they couldn't, he's a homeboy from my area, Denver, and you couldn't find a better representative and a more knowledgeable attorney than Jeff Clayton.
Mr. Weber, not to retract to an issue before, but do you know how Denver County is funding that pretrial system?
I don't.
Or how much it costs?
I don't.
Okay.
And those figures, like I said, seem to be very hard to find.
Procure, right?
I,
yeah. They're out there, but no one's willing to divulge.
Somebody doesn't want to divulge.
Of course not. They don't want to take the blame.
Sure.
And you know, and honestly, thinking logically, and today in politics and common sense, I hate that word because I have that. I think I thought I had that, but when I compare it to some other people's common sense, that's not it. So common sense bail reform, pretrial release has a place. Absolutely, I think it does. For minor offenders, truly minor offenders, first, even maybe second offense of a low-class misdemeanor, things like that. Absolutely, why should you? Most bail bondsmen don't want to mess with a $500 bond anyway.
You know, I'm of the belief, because we are oversighted by the insurance department, that we are an insurance, and just like an auto insurance or health insurance or anything like that,
absolutely.
I need the $500 guy that's guaranteed to go to court in order to pay for the $5,000 guy that isn't going to go to court.
It's a risk pool that all needs to be spread apart. And I don't think anybody could make the argument that that guy is such a safe driver, he shouldn't carry insurance. Or that guy is in such good health, he shouldn't carry health insurance. We all understand that the more participation in the pool keeps the cost down, absolutely, keeps it affordable, and keeps it running. But if we're going to slate off all of these safe people and only list leave bail bonds with high risk, the costs are going to go high, and we're going to continue with this story that the bail bondsman ripped me off. He charged me $3,000, and I was innocent, and this and that. And, you know, the defense attorney is going to hear from every defendant that walks in there, I can't pay you because I already paid my bondsman $3,000. Every judge is going to hear, I can't give you my fine because I had to pay my bondsman $3,000. You know, it's just,
everybody
should be subject to carrying insurance if you're arrested by law.
Mr. Chair, if I may, surely, being in the insurance business myself, I have to say, you know, let's keep that away from the insurance side of things, because it's actually more like a line of credit. It's a financial guarantee that you're giving. You know, you're not insuring anybody. You're saying, I'm going to back this guy, and if he skips on me, then I got to go after him.
I've got to mitigate my costs.
Yeah, I got to make sure that the bond doesn't get called in, because I'm on the hook for it. And so it's a financial guarantee. It's kind of like a line of credit. You know, the banks are going to check your background, check your credit history, and all that kind of stuff.
There's no legal requirement for our customer to pay us back on the whatever loss we do on our indemnification.
Right, it's a little bit different in that aspect, but I think we could compare this a little bit closer to what happened with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You know, the lack of underwriting and the lack of scrutiny destroyed it. I mean, that caused it to almost fail.
By writing bad paper.
Bad paper. Yeah.
That's what we don't do, though.
Right.
But
the lack of the proper regulations, like Mr. Weber said, there's good regulation, there's bad regulation. And Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae failed because of, all of a sudden, they said, open it up. We don't care what you loan on what. So, you know, you guys are doing it the right way, but going to pretrial release does it the other way. That puts the taxpayers on the hook.
Correct.
Not the surety.
Well put, Mr. Owen.
I like your gentleman you mentioned that you knew in Denver that says it's accountable versus non-accountable, because that's exactly the way it is.
That is exactly what it is. And I bet I have it here somewhere, but that guy is actually in New Orleans, has started an association that's a non-fee membership thing that's called National Bail Agents Association. And his whole thing, his name's Matt Dennis, his whole thing is uniting bail agents nationwide to fight pretrial. So if you just simply go to the website, it's nbaa.us, and you can find it there. It's dawned on me, so I didn't even turn this on. But, and along with American Bail Coalition, those two entities are the ones that I'm personally familiar with that are actively doing things to fight this. And somebody over here brought up the fact that one of the problems with us in the bail industry, I was at one of our company national conventions here a couple years ago, and one of the entire days was taken up talking about pretrial and how to combat it. One of the issues is the public, the general voting, taxpaying public, doesn't know the first thing about it. They know what bail is, and that's about it. Hell, I was in law enforcement for 30 years, and I knew what bail bondsmen did, and that was about it. Until I got
into it. People don't understand the process.
So people don't understand commercial surety, bail. They just don't bail.
Well, and when we're liable, you know,
so how do you
financially,
educate?
And that's a good question, but I believe, like Mr. Otis said, here in Utah, we're all about the second chance, you know, and we have the bleeding heart, and so when they come, that's how it was sold here, is there are poor people sitting in jail. Well, here in Utah, there's enough big surety-backed companies. They'll take payments. If you got $20, you're not going to sit in jail. So I find that hard to believe. And when they did an audit, they looked at some percentages. Well, who's sitting in jail? You know, you've got your people that are sentenced, you've got your people that are sitting in jail that for a violation of probation or a court hold, and then you've got people that have bail. Well, the problem is, they combined cash bail with regular bail, and so it made the percentage high. Cash bail has nothing to do with this. That is a judge's issued a warrant that's cash because they either A, want to see them, they want their money, they didn't pay their fine, and they're not being released until they do. If you separate those two, I mean, Wayne, what was our failure to appear rate that we paid on forfeitures last year?
2015, I haven't got 16, but okay. 0.0028%.
Yeah. So we're 99% accurate. You know, we do it 99% of the time. And isn't that what it's about? People get accused of crimes, they get arrested. What is the point? It's to bring them to justice, to have them go through that process. I'm not the judge or jury. You're not the judge or jury. It's the judge's.
Exactly.
It's at his discretion. And they bill this as, well, we're going to use this algorithm and the judge has the final say. I want to know what judge is going to be at the jail at 2 a.m. with the final say, because the judge isn't going to know what happened until after the person is released. And that's scary to me.
You all have bail schedules here?
We do.
Yes.
See, Colorado used to have, back when I was in law enforcement, we had a bail schedule, so I could tell someone on a simple DUI charge, this is what your bail's going to be.
We do on misdemeanors on felony.
Personally, I thought that always worked pretty well.
Yeah.
Ours has been changed to uniform bail and fine schedule.
I think the attempt was to drop bail altogether, yeah. and with some pushback, that remained, and then fine got added to the fine.
Another thing we have worried about the cost of the person who can't afford it, you still have no problem putting on restrictions where you're going to pay an ankle monitor monthly. It's going to cost twice as much as we have to ask.
That's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Because almost every, I got to get out of the sun here. Almost everywhere you look, what you would pay a bail bondsman, it costs you more to go through the no charge release program, especially if they put you on weekly or two-week DAs and an ankle monitor, and then there's like $100 court costs or whatever it is right away. And some places, some of my agents have told me that they actually have defendants who go, I just want a bail bond.
Yeah,
and then they won't let them. Mike, you're going to use pretrial, even if you want a bond.
The other thing is, we talked about the public, and the problem with the public, they're not informed, they're not educated, and they don't understand it's going to affect them in two ways. One is in the wallet. The state's going to pay this, it's going to come out of our taxes.
Sure.
And the other thing is, they don't understand what it's going to do to society, and these people are back out on the street. And if they understood the danger to society and what it's going to cost them on their bottom line, they would step up, but that has never, ever been brought.
One of the things in some of these programs, one of their selling points that actually makes me laugh, is that it's going to increase public safety. pull the weeds. I mean, sell that to people who don't know.
That's a scary thing. You take away consequences, that's a scary thing.
You know, and I mean, I've read some of these programs that when they're talking about them, and you know, they talk about public safety and these people shouldn't be in jail just because they're poor or just because they're some sort of ethnicity. And we need to get them out so that they can go back to work, be with their family. And you know, when we talk about common sense, bail reform. Well, 30 years in law enforcement, I can tell you that the truth of the matter is, whether you like to hear it or not, is that a lot of these people, a lot of them, are career criminals. They don't have a job. If it is, it's selling drugs or selling stuff that they just stole. And many instances that I'm personally aware of, their family divorced themselves of this guy years ago. So, yes, those are things to consider, but don't sell them to me as reality, because I know better.
Just curious, Colorado, you might be able to speak on it, but what position does law enforcement have on pretrial?
Most of them are against it because, well, I shouldn't say most of them. Many of them that I still have contact with don't like it because it enhances their job load. Because they have these people, I can give you an example, and it was a publicized in the Pueblo Chieftain, which is their local newspaper in Pueblo, Colorado, of people who were released on pretrial that were involved in an auto theft ring. And as soon as they got back out, which was like a day, they're right back to business as usual. And they're driving the cops nuts because they were stealing cars off the drive. It was merely, to them, a bump in the road. So, I mean, we all in the business know that it's a loser. It's a losing proposition.
Mr. Weber, if I may interrupt for a moment and suspend our discussion, because we could probably go on for four more hours. We've had Senator Adams come in, and we'd like to have him speak and give him an opportunity to address us while he's here and not waste his time. So
sure.
I'll move on to a next subject of new business, which is our talk about SB 167, Senator Stuart Adams. Too. Appreciate you being here.
I wish he could have been here.
More of our discussion. Yeah. Well, if you want to stick around, we'll rehash it.
We're just getting started.
Yeah. I know former representative all that well enough. He'll make sure I know. So, we spent a lot of time together, but I have to sell weapons for this. So, you know, I don't think I can be a friend with Kurtz and not have it. So.
Well, you better be packing right now.
Well, I'm not disclosing anything, so.
You're among friends.
There we go.
Yeah.
Appreciate being here. Appreciate the sandwich, too. And, I don't know who's taking care of this. The bill was written because of specific problems we've had with cash bonds. And I don't know. Some of you probably have had more experience with it than I have. But if you thought about what's happened, or if anybody wants to chime in on that, then I'll talk about the intent of the legislation.
I can speak to it a little bit. Specifically, 4th District, 6th District, and 11th and 7th. Spotty in most of the other districts, some of the judges have decided that they would just simply establish bail, cash bail, at a lower amount, and then a higher amount, bondable bail, and then give the defendant the opportunity to choose which one he wanted to do. Well, basically, that was happening a lot, mostly in 4th District, and our business, of course, just going south down there. So we thought, well, bail should be bail. Once bail's established, it should be cash bail or bondable bail, whichever one it is. The judge establishes bail, and then it could be what it is. So that's when we basically approached you about sponsoring the bill to make that, to address that issue and make it exactly what it is. From a constitutional point of view, bail should be offered. It should be equal. We felt it should be equal. So that's what that was addressing.
So that's part of the background of it, but I think it actually has a more significant policy issue, and that is, it's constitutional, Ellis constitutional, but I think even as important as that, maybe more so, is that when our forefathers came up with this idea of governance, they found a balance of powers, and the reason they did that is because there's inherent conflicts of interest inside of government, and they believed in a balanced system. And it's 101, we all know it, we have an executive and legislative and a judicial branch of government, and there are checks and balances on each other. And the reason for that is you just don't want to centralize. A lot more efficient to have a dictatorship. We all know that, especially if I'm a dictator, things will become right, but you don't have to have a question about the best way. But that's not how we function. And so we function trying to diminish the ability for conflict of interest. So generally speaking, that if a judge is able to set cash bail, and he's able to, and the cash, and we haven't received really good data as to what the judge is using when that bail is forfeited, what it's being used for. And it may be used for restitution, it may be used for whatever, but if it's used for court fees or court services, what you have is you have a real problem with that balance of power, because you have the person who is setting the bail with a potential conflict of interest if that bail is used for services inside of his operation. I think that's pretty 101 problematic policy, is that that's just not the way we do things in a democratic society, especially when it has that balance of powers. And so you can see it now in my mind. You're seeing an op-ed written, and I'd like to talk to some of the judges that are writing them, basically saying that somehow the legislature got it wrong. Well, there's 104 members of the legislative body, and they felt the same way, that this may not be the best policy, is that a judge be the decider of not only the bail, but where that bail gets spent, and if that bail goes to benefit themselves, and however else it's used. So the bill simply, without any question, without any, I think, there can't be a question on the legislative intent, listen to the hearing. But the idea was that if they're going to set bail, whether it's cash or whether it's otherwise, it has to be the same. Same amount of bail. Is it 500 is 500, 5,000 is 5,000, 100,000 is 100,000, cash or bail. And my concern is right now that I'm hearing rumors, and some of the personal experience about it, that they're basically ignoring. Again, that they're saying that they don't believe in that balance of powers, that the legislature ought to determine the policy and the executive branch ought to spend the money, but we determine how much they spend, and the judicial branch ought to just rule if something's unconstitutional or something. When we set the policy, they shouldn't be able to legislate from the bench or ignore it. But that's why we have so many people. And I haven't seen any of the judges, and maybe I'm getting a little bit off the subject, but most judges that are elected, it's just a yes or no. But for me, I have to go back and I have to face my constituents. And it's a political process, and that's why you have this balance. And I don't believe that a judge who is basically appointed and then has a yes or no vote can still reflect the constituency that they have in the way that we can as a legislature. So I see it as a problem, and I'm not sure what you wanted to hear from me, but I think if you're looking for legislative intent, I think I heard that that's one of the things you'd like me to talk about, is you go back and look at the history or the comments that were had as the bill was passed, and the intent was that the bail should be the same whether it's cash or whether it's, the bond should be the same whether it's cash or bond. So,
you know, I haven't been watching it terribly close. I do know a bit about what's going on in Utah County. I do know they continue to pass low cash bail instead of bondable bail. But I haven't heard very many circumstances of somebody who has $500 offered, $500 cash bail, and $5,000 bondable. Have they just basically gotten away from the bondable altogether, right? And only offered the cash only?
Yeah, they are still doing both.
Oh, they're still doing both.
So talk about that. I'd like to know what you're doing.
So in Utah County, there have even been inmates that have called and they have like a $5,000 bond. And so we contact the family. We're, you know, making all the arrangements, getting a co-signer, see, making sure that they're qualified to go write the bond. And then a lot of times they'll call 2 or 3 hours later and say they just changed it to 350 cash only.
But is the 5,000 bondable still there?
No.
So they've gotten rid of the bondable.
So they've actually, because some of my agents down there have even asked the judges, like, what's going on? You know, we thought we passed this through the legislature. We thought that this, and they said, we made those decisions.
The option's not there for a bondable bail anymore.
And it's, sometimes it's done in court in front of the judge. And so they'll walk in and they've got a $5,000 bond, and the judge will say, well, let's make that $250. You got $250, you can get out. And at that point, you don't know whether they're taking away the bond will bail at $5,000 or not. The judge just says, if you got $250, you can get out.
That's maybe clearly a violation. If it's $250, ought to be bondable.
Exactly.
Well, and 5 years ago, 10 years ago, if there was a cash bail, it was generally a fine that wasn't paid, or it was set at kind of a ridiculous amount because you knew the judge wanted to see the defendant. You know, it was $10,000 and $5 cash only. That was because the guy had failed to appear a few times, and the judge wanted to see him. He was making a point. Or it was a fine. You'd get on court exchange, you'd read the docket, and it would say this defendant is ordered to pay $680, $50 a month, and then they wouldn't. And so there'd be a warrant issued for $680, which was their fine amount. That's not the case anymore. It's just some random, I don't even know how they come up with it.
So the other thing that I think, besides being a balance of powers and question with my mind, if it's not a constitutional, it's bad policy to have somebody setting I see impact fees all the time. When cities lack money, they just crank up the impact fees to be able to cover their, you know, whatever their needed expenditures are, rather than raise taxes. And if you can just increase the amount of money that, if you happen to say, now we're going to raise it to $1,000 for everyone because we need more secretarial help or we need more supplies, that if where that money goes is a big deal. But beyond that, I'm also questioning, now, if somebody fails to appear, as you have the responsibility, at least those that I see some companies here, to go get that person and deliver them. If they have a cash
bail. Here, that money's forfeited.
That money's forfeited, but who has the responsibility to go bring that person?
Taxpayer.
The taxpayer.
So the taxpayer. So if in fact they're going to do that, then they're going to take that on, whether it's legislative or their own prerogative, there's a fiscal note to it or a cost to it for the taxpayer. And they come to us all the time for funding, and they've got to deal with that. And it's not their budget, it's, you know, the county sheriff or over the nation's budget. And this is a bigger issue than just a judge saying, this is how I want to handle it, this is my opinion. And that's what I'm trying to say, is it's just not their opinion. And I take exception to the fact that they believe that they all-knowing know what's right, and that they can't run through a process of convincing either 104 people or somebody else what's right.
Well, and what's concerning to me is we ran that bill and everything, and we thought, oh, we fixed the problem. And now, how have they worded it, Wayne? They come back and said, well, the language leaves it open to interpretation, and this is what we decided it needs.
They said that it needs more definition. That's not directed to me. That's a
so we probably need to.
Exactly what they're talking about. First,
I don't know. But the thing that's also interesting is it almost seems like there had to have been some discussion about it because more courts are doing it now, which is interesting.
Since the legislation passed. Mm-hmm.
Are they doing it before an arraignment, or are they doing it at the time of arraignment? Oh. Because if they're seeing them in court, that's what that arraignment's for.
Sure.
Arraignment and bail hearing. Mm-hmm. So we might have somebody sit for 12 hours in custody mm-hmm. overnight, go to court, uniform bail is set at the time of booking, but then they go to arraignment and the judge has that
but sometimes
ability to reduce sure. Or some, increase.
Sure.
And so I guess I'm confused on when they're making our decision.
But they're changing bail a lot of times. I mean, okay, Davis County. I live in Davis County. That's probably the jail I'm the most familiar with. So in Davis County, somebody gets booked in on, even on a misdemeanor. They go by the bail schedule or whatever, they're booked in on it, and so say it's a domestic violence, domestic in presence of a child, and the bail, I just had one last week, the bail from the bail schedule was like $1,950.
Right.
Called the parents, got everything lined up, went over there to get them out, and it had been maybe an hour and a half, and it was in the evening. Go over to get them out, get the booking sheet, and the bail's changed to $2,500.
Well,
the kid's in booking. Hasn't been arraigned, nothing's happened, but the on-call judge changed
it. I was going to say, the judge, mm-hmm. once probable cause is read,
sure.
they have the ability to change the
bond. And I mean, it is what it is, that's
fine. And probable cause now is within 24 sure. hours. So.
But the problem is, in some of the other counties, it will be set at $5,000 bondable, and then within a few hours, they haven't gone through the court process, they haven't been arraigned, it's changed to $350 cash only before anything's even been established. And so they haven't spoke to an attorney, they haven't, I mean, it's just happening.
So the judge usually sets that. Mm-hmm. So they call
yeah,
the
judge. Yeah, the judge said. Mm-hmm.
So we probably need some documented information as to who's ignoring the legislation and where, just where, what, and why, so that we can respond.
And what counties, the
what
ones
counties.
That are here.
And again, if they're changing the amount,
well,
they probably have the prerogative. The
sure.
legislation simply said it's sure. the same cash or bondable. And that's where we need documentation, is if they're going $5,000 bondable and $500 cash, or 500 cash only, that has to be bondable.
Stuff together.
If they want to change it to $500, they can, but I think it has to be long.
Yeah, I'm actually look forward to addressing that because it has been an issue.
So, my email's on the website. You can get it there, or there'll be, Jody Hart was, I think, the lobbyist.
Jody.
And so if you got her information, you can get it to her too.
Sure.
Okay. Other questions? If not.
No, it's not. I thank you, Senator Adams, for your efforts on behalf of the Belmont industry and as a citizen of Utah. It's a good thing that we have some folks that are in the legislature that are paying attention to some of the stuff that's going on, because sometimes I feel like we're alone in this whole endeavor, so we do very much appreciate your efforts.
Appreciate what you do. These are tough situations typically when people are in them, but I paid attention to the discussion earlier. Generally speaking, you're dealing with not only the issue of cash versus bail bondable, but when people go out, it's a cost to bring them back, but also there's a decision as to the safety in the community too. So it's a bigger deal than I think that some people really have said in the press.
Yeah. Absolutely. First, I concern myself as a bondsman, and secondly, I find myself as a Utah citizen and a parent of children here in Utah, and I want us to be a great state that it always has been. I hate to see any erosion in criminal accountability.
Senator, it was also brought up earlier that right now Utah taxpayers are on the hook for over 200,000 warrants, outstanding warrants of Scott Skibbs.
So why is that? Because there was no bond issued?
Well, there's no mechanism to actively seek out the warrant. Once the warrant is placed, it just sits on, sits on a database until, and generally what happens is somebody is arrested on a warrant because they were actually caught doing another crime. Anecdotally, from the bail bonds, but that's what I've seen.
Yeah, I had the opportunity.
But if they'd have been bonded, it'd be different, what you're saying.
If they'd have been bonded, we would have probably had a co-signer involved that intervened in their life and said, look, you're not going out tonight, or you're going to go get a job, or...
Yeah, mom or dad or uncle or whatever, and say, hey, you put me on the hook, I want you to appear. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't work, then they hire bail enforcement to go after them.
You know, if I could just say one thing, I had the opportunity to serve on the Supreme Court's pretrial release board along with Gary Walton from Beehive Bail Bonds. And another, there are two things that they were also trying to deal with. One is just having judges add zeros to the bail amount. You know, they should be able to make a decision, bail or no bail, instead of just adding zeros to people couldn't afford it because they had constitutional issues with that. And on the other hand, it's more efficient, their data indicated it was more efficient to issue a warrant rather than arrest everybody. So they used the example of a 16-year-old caught smoking a cigarette in, they used Davis County as an example, they would actually get arrested and get booked into jail when a warrant would be more efficient. So there's all these pieces of that
need to be
balanced.
I need a citation.
Thank you.
Warrant right off the bat. Wow.
I was going to say, the whole point is the warrant.
And then it's the warrant when they don't show up for a citation.
I think we need to
Is that why we have so many warrants? Is through the citations?
I don't believe that's the majority
of them. We need to do some kind of a study of that 200,000 warrants and find out exactly what they are.
Because you could have a non-compliant warrant versus a failure to appear warrant. And if you're putting those two together, you're getting a not a good data number.
But regardless, the courts should be held accountable for not following up with them.
Correct.
I think a lot of that Salt Lake County not being able to book people into jail. So the officers continually give them tickets. They don't show they already have 40 warrants.
Warrants
issue. Plus one more.
Because I thought most of the warrants were because of some accounting stuff.
Appreciate you having me here. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you.
We'll give you a minute to gather yourself after you read this ridiculous piece of information.
I can always talk.
Yeah.
Another thing, I guess, that I want to bring up, because I do bail enforcement, and I actually am very involved with that. I sit on the board at BCI as well. But part of their data in the audit that was ridiculous to me is they said, you know, bail enforcement's not really picking people up. I mean, it just doesn't happen very often. I have cases and files to the tune of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And the way that data may not look like that is, like Clay had mentioned earlier, a lot of times when people get picked up, they're committing other crimes. Although I have the authority to apprehend somebody because they have a warrant and I'm going off of the bail contract, if they have drugs on them, if they were involved in a high-speed chase, if, you know, there's a violation of a protective order, we have to have law enforcement involved because I can't charge them with new charges. And I have to tell you, my guess would probably be 9 times out of 10, when we arrest somebody, there's some type of drugs involved, either on their person, in the vehicle, where in the house or whatever, the residence that they're in. And so we have to notify law enforcement and get them involved because I can't charge them. And so that's what made those numbers look a little different.
And another agency is getting the credit.
PD gets credit for the arrest even though it was.
But do you still show the revoked bond on your previous, do you file?
We usually do, but a lot of times law enforcement takes them into custody. We have them handcuffed. We have the whole thing figured out. We get law enforcement involved, and because we can't book them on new charges,
right,
as long as our warrant is served, then technically our bond should be exonerated.
Right.
So a lot of times we literally just have to hand them over to law enforcement, take them, and then a lot of times we'll call and say, hey, did you get them booked in on that warrant? And sometimes in some counties, like Weaver County's a nightmare, they want it in writing directly to the court, and so we have to notify them.
Right.
They don't just go off of the booked warrant, even though that's how the statute reads.
We follow the docket and make sure that it's
yeah. But so that's super frustrating because nobody's going to tell me, I don't care who they are, the bail enforcement, we're out 6 nights a week. Sometimes we pick up 5 people in one night.
Yeah.
And we do it full time.
Would it be helpful if there was some kind of uniform procedure statewide?
It would be interesting because here's another thing. So they redid, they used to have GEMS at Salt Lake County, and now they have OMS, which I miss F1, F2, I gotta tell you. I don't even know if I struggle. Every time we go to book somebody in Utah County, I have a panic attack. But they used to have a drop-down screen, and even in Davis County, they had a drop-down screen where it would say bond revoke, bail enforcement. It's gone. So now it'll say prisoner transport or Davis County Sheriff's Office or other, or, and so they wonder why we don't get the credit, or they think we don't do anything. They're not even a spot for us anymore.
Who tracks your data on your?
Nobody.
Nobody.
I was gonna say, because that's not something that
nobody.
We want a UCR report for VCI
yeah.
or
nobody
something
does.
Like that.
I mean, we like to give proof to the bondsman, you
sure.
know, and that's hard too, because it's hard to say, hey, we got your case, we found the guy, he had a ton of dope on him, we had to get the police involved, he's being booked in, you know, to the jail right now, and so usually we'll take a picture of the defendant in custody or get a booking report or whatever, but it shows that the Salt Lake police booked
right.
him.
I know we kind of broke up the continuity of our conversation, so if anybody has any other questions for Mr. Weber, it'd be a good time to ask them before I close our meeting.
I have business cards and you want to contact me, but I just want to reiterate there, like I said, there are two active national associations, ABC, American Bail Coalition, with Jeff Clayton is more, he focuses primarily on legislative type things, but the other Bail Agents Association is the one that I gave you, NDAA.us. And it's the director of it is the guy who started it, Matt Dennis, in Louisiana. And he is like a bulldog on this stuff. He absolutely will not quit. And he's spent, I don't know how much money, but he's not fighting this. It's a worthy fight.
And he's familiar with what's happening nationwide.
He also does a weekly, or maybe it's even more often than that, internet radio broadcast about this topic with different speakers. And it's if nothing else, it will educate you as to the dilemma of this nationwide, and it is nationwide. So.
Thank you.
Thank you all for having me. I always enjoyed talking about bail stuff. Even though this pretrial is very frustrating in some respects, but all we can do is fight the good fight. Eventually, we will win out. We will. Because accountable bail is the only thing that works. It's worked for hundreds of years. And so it will prevail. But like,
so if we have a rich uncle, we might make it.
You know, if you can weather the storms, it's cropping up in Boise, Idaho. I have a couple big agents there, and they called me going, holy crap. And I go, I know. Get involved politically, legislatively, and be solid as you can to weather the storm, because it will come and go. But
what we would hope is that one state can look and see what's happening in another state and look at the disaster. There's never been a good outcome from it. And equally be able to look at the other states, realize that's the same thing being implemented here, and avoid it rather than step in the same pitfalls that everybody else has done. There isn't a success.
Sometimes the political agenda seems bigger than common sense.
That is a logical thing.
If you just look at New Jersey or numerous other places, you can go, wow, we don't want to do that here. But
The only place that says it's good is the Harvard study, which Arnold Foundation paid the Harvard study.
If you're in the bail industry, bail enforcement, law enforcement, you get that common sense for criminal activity. And it's different than what the average citizen understands about it.
And that is, I believe, a huge issue is the uneducated general public. But how to best, that big meeting we had nationally back in Indiana a year ago, this was like the biggest topic. How can we educate the general public about bail and explain to them the pretrial is going to cost you, the taxpayer, more money? How do you do that?
What needs information?
And who's going to pay for it?
Well, and it doesn't cure the problem.
Exactly.
I don't know of a jurisdiction yet that introduced these types of programs and then, you know, shouted from the rooftops that we found it.
Yes, yeah, because
we've solved the problem.
Anywhere that this legislative thing has taken place, it's never. I don't think New Jersey was a vote of the people. If it was a one-sided campaign.
Well, everybody knows most people in New Jersey have probably already been in jail or have a loved one who is in jail, so that's probably why they didn't vote for it there.
They're either been in jail or they're going to be.
They moved out of New York to avoid jail.
They're either on their way in or on their way out of jail. So.
Well, and the problem, too, is the dynamics of our state compared to others is quite drastic. I still can't buy the there are poor people sitting in jail that can't get out. I don't buy it. I think that if there are people in jail that are sitting there that can't get out, like I said, in Utah, there's companies that will get you out for $20. They've stolen from grandma. They robbed the neighbors. They abandoned their children. They've done 10 other crimes they didn't get caught for. And their people have had it. And you know what? Maybe those are the ones that if they do get out, they're going to immediately commit a new crime. Maybe those are the ones that do need to be there for a minute and get their head on.
So we have a system that addresses that already.
Exactly.
Yes.
That exactly. If a judge feels that it's a first-time criminal, that we need to cut him a break or whatever, then he can alarm.
I had this discussion with my Boise agent the other day when she called in a panic that this thing is encroaching on in Boise. I think in Utah, you're very much like Colorado, and as is Idaho and Montana and many of the western states. I really believe that in Colorado, the reason that there has not been a blanket legislation to abolish bail and to have some sort of local governmental jurisdiction head this thing up and it's tax funded is because in Colorado, as in these other states I mentioned, there are so many little tiny counties that are sparsely populated with very little population and very little budget that they could not begin to afford something like this.
That's what's interesting about Utah is we have the court administrator's office, which is mandating it to every jurisdiction in the state of Utah.
It's optional. It's not mandated yet because our judge is pushing back.
They signed a contract.
They signed a contract to say it's mandated.
Our judge does not like it, and she is pushing back. So.
Well, that's what it's going to take.
But here's what's concerning me, because that when I called one of the sergeants at the Davis County Jail, I said, have you heard about this pretrial? You know what's going on, and I kind of explained it, and she, her exact words, our judges will never go for this. But here's the problem. It will be done before the judge knows. So,
oh, yeah, I have to go train on it on Thursday.
Yeah.
Like, it's coming.
No,
as far as we understand it right now, the training that we're attempting to go to right now, we're told that it's optional right now. Mm-hmm. So until
that's to calm your
yeah,
I guess
so
really
you don't go up.
And then we found that the jails had input on a lot of this stuff, and first I have heard of it. We have not yet. Nobody has consulted us.
Yeah,
on
nobody consulted us. They just kind of did it, and
well,
it's
because they're so proud of their program.
And the thing that's really scary is Speaker of the House and Speaker of the Senate has sent a letter asking them to please slow, put the brakes on. We need to look at this. No response. They're going to do it. They're going to do what they do. And it's unfortunately because Utah is known as the best state for their budget, for the way they run the thing, and they are looking at millions of dollars financially, and nobody even sees it coming. And we're just saying, I mean, aside that this is the industry I'm in, I own a home, I have kids, it's a public safety issue. You look at the gateway down there, we're doing Rio Grande right now, the big project down there. If people don't think that stems from criminals not being held accountable, they are wrong. Those two, the homeless situation, the drug situation we have, anybody that's in this industry, in the criminal justice at all, knows that those go hand in hand. They just spent how many millions of dollars building Farmington Station in Farmington? Beautiful, high-end stores, shopping. It's been great for Davis County. Well, guess what's across the street from Farmington Station? The Davis County Jail.
The Gateway had a big enough problem with the Salt Lake County Jail. The Salt Lake
exactly.
County Jail is 5 miles away.
Mm-hmm. It's right across the street.
Their salad door is literally facing the mall.
When they put people into the Davis County Jail,
here you guys go.
And they're pre-trialed, and they don't have a ride, and where do you think they're going to go? They're going to walk right across the street. They're going to shoplift something to get money, to get on tracks,
beg
or whatever.
For money.
It's going to happen.
Mother. Did I hear you say that the Speaker and the Senate President both sent letters?
Same
and
letter.
And that was to whom?
They both signed one letter to Rick Schwarmer, the director of the...
I know Schwarmer.
And Supreme Court Justice Durant.
Had no response.
No response. You know, as of this morning, no response.
How long ago was that?
About maybe 12 days ago.
Okay. They usually figure 30-day response time. Okay. So kind of simple. So
that'll take us to November.
Okay.
They're supposed to implement it November 13th, and we're scared.
Okay.
Once you get a
so
program,
I would
that.
Stay in touch with the Speaker and the Senate President. And maybe through the chair,
sure.
And ask them to please follow up with that,
mm-hmm.
because
I call every day.
Well, don't overdo it.
Well, I don't call. I call the right person every day.
Okay. Yeah, be careful, Wayne.
But that letter was dated September 20th.
The letter was?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, you're talking 60 days now, so. Yeah, it needs to be followed up at this point. Like, because this is not for the record. I'm just so glad that Justice Durham is stepping down. Because she was leading the charge on some of this stuff.
Well, at the end of the day, we sit here and we see the other states that have done this and the mistakes that have been made. And all we're saying is involve us, and if some changes need to be made, let's make them. But my word, public safety is at risk. It's a joke. And then how do you backtrack after millions of dollars are spent?
The latest ticket I saw in New Jersey for this was $500 million is what they were wanting. $500 million. It didn't start out like that, but they were fumbling and then came back to the legislature and said, well, we really, really gonna need $500 million to get this done right.
Yeah. And I mean, the price tag that comes with this is people don't realize what this private industry shoulders as an industry. And when you put that in a governmental umbrella, it's a ton of money to run it.
And again, it's not just the money, it's the additional consequences of recommitted crimes.
And on that point, you mentioned there's 200,000 active warrants out there, and that may be a taxpayer burden, but probably more importantly is there's a significant number of victims of crimes involved in that 200,000 that aren't being served on their behalf, yeah. Which is a re-victimization all over again, as far as that's I'm concerned. So.
Well, Rick Schwarmer's your buddy, we're talking.
Rick Schwarmer is very close-minded,
to say the least.
Maybe I'll take him out for a drink. I don't know what he likes.
I have a question about the court administrator. I understand that the governor's general counsel, J.C. Skinner, has given her notice that she is.
Yes.
Her new role will be a deputy court administrator. Does that mean somebody is leaving?
Dan Becker's stepping down.
Who?
Dan Becker.
I don't know.
Well, didn't Schwarmer take Becker's position?
I think so.
Does anybody know Judge PSA? Does anybody know Judge PSA?
I wondered that.
Well, thank you again, Mr. Weber, for coming.
Absolutely.
To speak.
Absolutely, thank
you for having me. And I'm sure we all appreciate it. So. We have no old business to take care of, and we have some other business.
Well, I just had one comment or request. And first of all, I want to thank Kathy for putting together another, I think, good bail agenda. About 2 years ago, Kathy started really trying to have an interesting speaker or component of this meeting that's more than just bail business. We had Keisha come, we had the bail enforcement lady last time. So if you have ideas for next time, people you'd like to...
We'd like to have Keisha back.
Or if there are certain topics that you're interested in, please let Kathy know. And, you know, the more advanced, the better, because people like, I think it was your name again, Mr. Meyer? Mr. Weber, I keep saying, I don't know why I thought Meyer, but people like Mr. Weber need some advance notice to get here. I also know that Kathy doesn't have a budget to fly Mr. Weber here, so we appreciate him coming, flying here to be with us here today. So
yeah,
that was my message.
Then, need a motion to adjourn or anything?